Gràcies per ser aquí. Per tant, començarem la jornada, com ha dit el vicerrector, una breu introducció del primer ponent, el doctor Amran Hamza. Good morning, Amran. Thank you for being here today. Doctor Amran Hamza comes from the University Technology Malaysia. He works in academy for a very long time, and so he's an expert people in academia in Malaysia. He's also in the University of Technology Malaysia. They are based in Johor Bahru. This is a Malaysian city, very next to Singapore. So actually, you just have to cross the channel, and then you are in Singapore. And along all these years, he's been publishing papers having to do with tourism, urban planning, urban development, national parks, protected areas, conservation, and so on. But one thing that I would like to highlight, having to do with what the vice rector said, is that he has always been involved in actually moving outside academia and being highly involved in implementing policies, advising the governments and so on for many, many years. So inside Malaysia, he also is the founder and the director of a research center who is based also at the university. And this research center is very, very active in working with different municipalities, towns, regions, the government of Malaysia. They've done very interesting and big projects, like maybe recently one of the biggest was the national ecotourism plan for Malaysia, where they identified different clusters in order to develop tourism in protected areas and so on. So and then recently, I think it was in the last couple of years, he was also elected as a representative of the regional a representative of Asia in at IUCN. So this is just a brief, a very broad introduction of Professor Hamza. I would also like to add that he comes from a region that culturally is different from, in this case, from Europe. I think this can add value also to get different perspectives about the problematics of conservation and protection, and then the use of these spaces for other things, like for living, like social issues, or for visiting, like tourism. That's why we are this triangle here represented in today's in today's session. And also, I would add that Malaysia, particularly in Southeast Asia, has some singularities, which is the internal variety of cultures that they have, with all the historical singularities of the Malay culture, the Chinese, the Indians, and so on. Beyond these main projects at the level of whole Malaysia, I would also like to highlight that Professor Hamza is very experienced in working in projects in the Malaysian provinces of Borneo Island in Sabah and Sarawak. And this is also an interesting case because many indigenous communities are affected there by the setting up of protected areas and national parks, Mount Kinabalu and many others. So he has done many, many, many research projects there, both academic research and also, let's say, policy-oriented. So it's a source of inspiration. So he will introduce now, the speech, with the speech, what he considers are relevant topics in this area. And then we will have the open conversation where we highly invite all of you to participate, because it's through this conversation that we will make the session more valuable and more useful for everybody. So this is everything that I had in my mind to introduce Professor Hamza. If I left anything relevant, just please, you can add it, okay? So please, take the floor, thank you.
You can use this one. Yeah, that's the way it works. Okay, thank you, Jaume, and buenos dias, and I would like to thank the university for inviting me. It's an honor, it's a privilege for me to come here and to experience, to learn about tourism here in protected areas. And I have spent about 4 days going around. Yesterday we were in Garocha, and we met Xavier and the mayor, Lewis, and we were by the coast the previous day. And today I've been asked to give a keynote address on a subject that is very close to my heart and something that I have been working on for many years. So this is, hopefully I can see it from here. Yeah, sure. The Asian philosophy of protected areas, as Jaume said, I'm from Asia, so it's culturally different, of course, from where you are. But Asia is a huge continent, very plural, and it's not easy for us, for me, to put together everything in Asia, but that is the job given to me about 7 years ago. In 2011, there was a workshop in Japan, attended by around 36 Asian countries. And there was an informal discussion among those who, the participants, and we asked, playfully asked, does Asia has a unique philosophy? Everybody said, yes, we do, but nobody could pinpoint what is our unique philosophy. And IUCN Asia Regional Office in Bangkok then challenged me, gave me a small grant to do a research on the Asian philosophy of protected areas, which started small. I didn't know that it was, it then became huge, maybe beyond my capacity. It took a year to do this, mainly through desk studies and emailing friends. Eventually, I was able to come out with the document that was presented as the plenary in the first Asian Parks Congress in Sendai, Japan, 2013. And until now, it has become a subject of really rigorous discourse among Asians and trying to find our own center, as you might call it, as philosophy. So I'm going to talk about this Asian philosophy in the context of the nature-culture linkages. So this is the summary. Yeah. So what I'm going to talk about are really three things. One, which is very central to the philosophy, is the harmony between humans and nature. And then what are the challenges that Asians are facing in terms of trying to maintain our harmony between human and nature. And I would then try to put forward some recommendations of how we can build on our philosophy for contemporary approaches in protected area management and ecotourism planning. So this is where we started about 9-10 years ago. So there was a lot of discussion around what is the model of protected areas that we are using. And in most Asian countries, we have been using what we call a colonial model, which we inherited from different colonial masters in the past. And it is based really on the first national park in the world, Yellowstone. 1872 was the first national park, first protected area in which local inhabitants, maybe the native Indians at that time, were driven out of their area, and then the whole area was declared as a national park. It's a beautiful, well-managed, until now, probably one of the best national parks in the world, but still, it works very well because the surrounding areas, they were not facing these four issues or problems that in protected areas in Asia are facing, which are displacement. Many of our local communities have been displaced. If not displaced, then they are also marginalized. And then, of course, there is, non-compliance. So even though they are displaced, they are going in again into their protected areas because they used to be their land and for sustainable livelihoods. And finally, of course, the contestations. Every now and then there are a lot of events, conflicts, until now in Malaysia, everywhere in Asia, local communities, indigenous communities blocking the way for people from going to national parks because they are considered as encroaching into their area. So these are the implications of having a colonial model, and I'm so happy to see yesterday that in this part of the world, your part of the world, the category 5, IUCN category 5, is more widespread. There's only one IUCN category 2, and then in Malaysia, this is the opposite. We have only one category 5, an island in Sabah. The rest are all IUCN national parks, which is exactly what the colonial models are. So this is a starting point of the debate and the discussion among Asians. Can we then try to find our own unique model? So we began by asking this question, whether there is such thing as a traditional protected area. Some people might laugh and say there is no such thing as a formal and a traditional, but for the sake of discussion, we like to call it there could be a traditional form of areas that are being protected. And these are mainly in the forms of sacred natural sites. They are all over Asia, and these are areas that are held with reverence, maybe because of the mountain gods and the beliefs in them. This is up on Mount Kinabalu in Sabah, the highest mountain in Southeast Asia, and people rarely regard it as a spiritual area. It's only regarded as a natural area. I'm going to talk about it in a while. So this is one of the examples. And from the 1 year research, we came to a conclusion that there is a consensus among Asian countries that we have this tradition and the philosophy of harmony between humans and nature. It is being severely challenged, has been in terms of physical development, but still, we Asians are very proud. This is the rice terraces in the Philippines. You can see that it's a World Heritage. Again, they have been given a yellow flag several years ago, but now they have, you know, rectified all the problems. That this is an example how the local communities are living in harmony with nature. So another discovery while doing this research was it something that Asians willingly subscribed to, or did something that was forced upon them? And I'm putting this argument that probably why we have to respect nature is because we are living in an area that is very vulnerable to natural disasters. And Asia is 25 times more susceptible to natural disasters than Europe or North America. So you have tsunamis, you have typhoons, and Indonesia, you know, every few months we have all sorts of natural disasters that if we do not plan, if we do not plan in harmony with nature, then we will be overwhelmed. So this is just a thought. It might be true. It hasn't been proven, but this is the reality. And the late Lee Kuan Yew was a fantastic former president of Singapore, has this to say: the Chinese and Japanese always believe that there may be an earthquake or some other disaster around the corner, so they feel the need to put something by. You can see the paintings in Chinese paintings, Japanese paintings, there's always the temple or the heart, you know, and it's always lying on a very fragile area. Yesterday we saw also from that view of Rarocha, is it what was in the village on top? Yeah, from this side, wow, you know. We were amazed to see how it was, this very Asian, you know, putting things in a very difficult situation and coping with it. So this is very Asian from the paintings that we can see. So let me quickly go through, this is just a snapshot of what is contained in the IUCN publication. If you have the time, interest, you can read through. I'm just trying to capture. This is in China. Of course, they have this Confucius, Confucianism, Taoism. They are always entrenched in this philosophy of harmony between humans and nature, and looking at nature as a whole rather than separating them, oneness with nature. And the Sun Tzu philosophy is something that blends mountain and water. This is a World Heritage Site, courtesy of Professor Trevor Sofield, who is a regular visitor here. So some of you might have seen this. So this is really, in the Western context, will never be granted a World Heritage, because you are putting something that is artificial on a natural, in a pristine area. But in the Chinese philosophy, there is adding essence, what is called essence, tiji, beautifying the area rather than causing conflicts. So this is similar to many of the national parks or natural reserves in China. There are some have been given World Heritage status, some are on the verge of getting them. And you can find this everywhere, this kind of oneness as an example. And calligraphy is very common in the caves in China. From Western eyes, they might say this is graffiti. But from the Chinese philosophy, it is calligraphy, where they write poems and prose from their very famous philosophers to adore these caves, and they become something that inspire them when they go into caves. But some people might say that, these are all graffiti, naughty guys writing things in there. So another example of this harmony between humans and nature are the Feng Shui forests. Feng Shui forests, there are around 6,000 left in China. There are even some in Hong Kong, on the islands, and I've been there. That village there at the bottom has been left, because all the people have migrated to Europe, but they still come back once a year to celebrate the Chinese New Year. And the hill at the side is a Feng Shui forest. They are always protected, even without any legal protection mechanisms. So Feng Shui forests are very, very rich in biodiversity. That is why we are trying to come out with a network of Feng Shui forests and try to link them up to complement the so-called formal protected areas. Am I going too fast? India, they have what you call is sacred groves, and there are more than 100,000 of them everywhere in India, and they attract millions of pilgrimage every year. And of course, they are very rich in biodiversity. Indians, the Hindus believe that there are a deity or god or many gods in there, so they do not dare touch it or develop it. And this has been the reason why there are so many sacred groves in India that need to be protected, because they are just given the status through the local use every day. Japan also, Chinju no Mori, is a small forest surrounding Shinto shrines. They are Buddhist plus Shintoism. And again, these are examples of harmonious relationships between humans and nature. South Korea, the Baekdu Dagon mountain system resembles the tiger, which is their national emblem. And within this, there are hundreds of sacred natural sites. And there are six different types of village forests, depending on their use and function. So again, this theme is coming out from all the Asian countries. Bhutan, for example, more than half of the country is protected. And many of them were done so mainly because of to protect them from enemies, and also to shape their political and religious worldview. Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar, the capital, is surrounded by four mountains, and these are revered as sacred mountains, so they do not dare to cut down them. Malaysia, where I come from, forests are believed to have good and evil spirits. So when we are designing ecotourism, we design trails for walking. Some are very short, some are very long and difficult to go. And those which are challenging are seldom used by Malaysians. International tourists like them, because Malaysians do not like to venture deep into the forest. There are too many ghosts or spirits. Until now, if you design something, it is more a Western design. Most Malaysians would just gather around the car park, have a picnic, throw rubbish and go back. The young ones maybe would venture. So some venturing into the forest, you will meet all those semangat hantu or the forest spirits. So they do not cut down the trees too because of that. And there are many other commonalities. I'm just trying to capture them all. So sacred natural sites are created out of reverence and respect for the physical elements. This is a map by Taiwanese indigenous people. It shows all this relationship between forest, spirits, and of course they believe that bad things will happen if you encroach upon them. So, but why has this interest in sacred natural sites suddenly appeared over the past maybe 10 years? Before that, nobody cared about this in Asia. So, one is the belief now, the realization that sacred sites, sacred natural sites and sacred groves and so on contain a lot of biodiversity. Some of the land owned by the church, for example, in Indonesia, nobody has touched them. So these are the reservoirs of rich biodiversity. And also because of the trying to meet the Aichi Target 11, 17% protected areas, terrestrial, and 10% by 2020. My country, Malaysia, for example, when we map out all our formal protected areas, we are still short by 2%. Maybe we are about 15. And then they say, how do we get in more to make the target? So now there is a special interest in indigenous people's area for burial grounds, sacred burial grounds, and so on, just to make up these informal areas that IUCN now is focusing on a lot. I can't remember the exact words. Probably colleagues can. You know, yes. Other effective measures, yeah. So there's a new theme. There is going to be given a lot of emphasis in the next World Conservation Congress in Marseille in 2020. So there's a lot of interest. One, because of the biodiversity. Number two, because to make up, you know, what we cannot get through the formal protection. So another form of socio-ecological landscapes that we have in Asia that have surfaced for the past several years are these, for example, in Japan, there are Satoyama, Satoumi, which is the traditional form of sustainable resource management, socio-ecological processes. They have a Satoyama initiative that is very popular everywhere in Asia. Not easy to implement in Japan anymore because the old people are only left in the villages. You need people to be able to sustain such kinds of cultural landscape. In Japan, many young people have left the villages, but in India, in Malaysia, there are still lots of young people, so they are crucial in sustaining these kinds of cultural landscape. That is why, for me, the Satoyama initiative is more popular elsewhere rather than the birthplace, which is Japan. We also have in Malaysia Tagal or Bombon, the prohibition from fishing. So once a year or twice a year, then everyone can come together and then the whole community can fish. Tourists also can come. This is a way, again, of resource management, identifying, recognizing the carrying capacity. The very famous Subak in Bali and the Philippines. These are integrated water temple systems that are under severe threats because tourism has came, of foreigners buying land to build villas and destroying that whole ecological systems. And this is for the use of combined production of rice, fish, and downstream products. So these are very unique Asian resource management systems, and also you have in Sri Lanka. Okay, so that's a snapshot. So we have, so people in Asia now begin to talk that, wow, we do have this. But now we are living in very different situation, environment. There are challenges. So number one is, how do we get the young to maintain their attachment to such spiritual beliefs, taboos. Young people don't have this, even in Asia, beliefs anymore. Decreasing emotional attachment to traditional beliefs and taboos. That's a huge challenge for us. These are young people. It's a festival once a year. Now, communities are allowed to go up Mount Kinabalu to do the rituals. And they have a five-day festival too. The young ones go there because of the festival. The elderly go there because of their respect for the mountain. So it's always difficult. So number on the left are the shamans. So every day they will be reciting prayers, calling for the mountain gods, you know, to leave them alone and to give peace. But those are the young kids who are performing from the villages. I ask them, next year will you come back? Yes, we will. What for? We want to perform. You know, do you believe in all these things? We are learning, but as long as they are getting out of their homes and going to natural areas, that is already a big achievement in Malaysia, because, you know, getting them to be physically attached first with nature, and then for them to discover the spiritual qualities that come second. So we are quite realistic about what we want to achieve. Yeah. Challenges, I think we have to be accept that there is already a homogeneous global community with the internet and so on, everybody having almost the same interest in current contemporary music, lifestyle and so on. And it could be a good vehicle, the internet, to really to showcase traditional values and traditions, but sometimes it doesn't work like that, and people are happy, you know, to know this is a global, it's a music and so on. So this is another threat. And the third one is legal protections. I've seen many of such sacred areas. This is beautiful in the valleys of Mount Kinabalu. It's a community forest. They have been going against the government for decades, and they are winning. But how long can such communities win if they don't have legal protection? Then it's very difficult. So very, very difficult to achieve. Another challenge is mainstream religions. So all these rituals, mainly associated with animism and so on, but you have contemporary Islam, contemporary Christianity and so on, they go to the villages and say that this is wrong, you cannot pray to the mountain gods, yeah? And they are erasing the human, ancient wisdom in human-environment relationships. The influx of domestic tourists, most of our national parks are, of course, they are open for tourism, and domestic tourists are on the rise, and also international tourists. This is the cave in China, and it is full of lights, and you might accuse it of, it's Trevor Sofield's photograph, Disneyfication, but they are well accepted by in China. I go up and I go to a national reserve in China, and it's so beautiful. But even at 5 o'clock, there are just too many people shouting, and I don't know whether, you know, they're doing it right or I'm the one who is wrong. And there is another kind of contemporary lifestyle that is emerging based on mimicking nature. This is Marina Sands, Gardens by the Bay in Singapore. These are artificial trees. They do absorb carbon dioxide and release oxygen, and they were well planned over a 5-year period. And you can walk across, and these are very, very popular with Asian parents and kids. So this is a whole complex. We have the domes, two domes inside, and they have giant trees linking up, and they have been designed to function in a very sustainable manner. And I think the Singapore government took many years to come to this decision to transform this some sort of a wasteland many years ago into this. And now you have in one of the domes a man-made cloud forest. You don't have to go to Costa Rica. There's one. The plants are taken. They are not artificial plants. They are transplanted there. And Asian families like it because there are no insects as compared to the real forest. And you don't need good walking shoes. And is climate control, air conditioning, especially for parents from China. They are afraid because they have one one child, policy now they're changing it, that if they allow their child to go into a real forest, they might lose it, and it's gone. So they prefer to see their children or child to play in this man-made mimicking nature. When it was open, maybe 10 years ago, there were only 2 million tourists, now more than 10 million tourists, mostly from Asia. So this is where you can play and you can even enjoy wildlife encounter. This is Chinese New Year, so you have, you know, snakes playfully, and they are happy to take photographs with it. Or do you really want this? This is the Malaysian jungle, fear factor. Some tourists do, you know. And in this cloud forest, you have all sorts of these animals and families are giggling, taking photos, and they get the same enjoyment that one might get if you happen to have this real encounter, if you're lucky. And do you want this? And all these are planned in a very systematic way, so they are not just for fun, they are contributing towards sustainable development, scientifically done. So this is the new thing. China is now trying to copy this, developing more and more of this. In Malaysia, there are three or four mimicking nature, so you can go to nature. And yet there are, of course, still many young people who like the real thing, but we are a bit worried that this could be the start of a new trend going this way. So let me go to, I hope I have time a bit more, Mount Kinabalu, which is our first natural World Heritage Site in Sabah. And it was established as protected area in 1964. This is based on the colonial model. All the local people were driven out until now. And when it was inscribed in 2000, it was based on only the scientific qualities, which are the exceptional levels of biological diversity and endemic species and so on. If you read the dossier, it doesn't say anything about the cultural values, cultural significance. And despite the fact that Akinabalu means resting, perpetual resting place of spirits of the ancestors. So the local communities believe that when you die, you don't go to heaven, but you are lying in between heaven and earth on the top of Mount Kinabalu. And the dossier, looked through thoroughly. They didn't even mention it, and yet they claim that the surrounding communities are the threat to the mountain's biodiversity. The opposite is true. Because of the reverence for the mountains, communities do not cut down the forest, do not cut down the trees. Rather than they are the ones who are causing this. So this is something that is very difficult to understand from the dossier that was written maybe in 1998. So, because the local communities have been driven out, they have been fighting for years for their rights to go into their so-called wandering area. So the director of Sabah Parks in 2010 went to one of the villages and met on the elderly lady and said, "Are you happy with the current situation?" They said, "No, we are angry at you because we are not allowed to go up the mountain anymore." So in 2010, for the first time, the Sabah Parks allowed the locals to go up once a year to pay the pilgrimage. And since then, Sabah Parks has been forgiven. Local people say, "Oh, they are nice, they allow it once a year." And now they have a festival, 4-day festival and so on. So this is something that shows that how important the spiritual values to the local communities. And once you restore that, there can be a better harmonious relationship between the governance system in Sabah. Because of this reverence also, there was an event in 2015 when one group of Western tourists went up there and posed naked, and it caused a furor in Malaysia, and there was an earthquake a week later. Maybe it's just coincidence. Malaysia has been spared from natural disasters. We don't have earthquakes. It's the first time there was an earthquake. And the local communities claim that it is because you have made the mountain gods angry by posing naked. And of course, the British tabloids then had a good time, you know, naked Brit girl caused killer quake, blah, blah, blah. And this shows, you know, the different cultural understanding. between people who subscribe to these cultural values and those who do not. And the reality is that the local guides risk their lives rescuing stranded young climbers to ensure they do not do it because they want to save them. Of course, they have saved them, but they want to preserve the sacredness of the mountains. So they have to do it, risking their own lives. And all in all, 16 people were killed, including 3 local guides, in trying to save the children. Now it has been restored, but earthquakes have become a common occurrence now. So what the lessons to be learned is that there is a very thin line between the sacred and the profane. And then because of the events, Sabah Parks realized that they have not considered spiritual values. They have not provided guidelines for climbers of how to behave. How do you respect local values, even though you don't believe in them? How do you then penalize trekkers who do not follow, because they were put in a lockup for one night and they were released because there was no law that could charge them? These are all native laws, like sacrificing a buffalo if you go, you know, and take away a tree. So there is no law that says that you cannot go naked on the mountain. So they just got scot-free, and now we realize that we have totally neglected the spiritual values of the mountain in designing guidelines, management for everyday use for tourism. So finally, is Community Day is fine. It's good because you bring back the relationship, you connect them, reconnect the locals with the mountain, but that is a personality-driven initiative. There has been no change in the overall governance structure, so we haven't moved on. So how do we try to reconcile this in a better way, in a more systematic way in the future, beyond just having one very kind director who wants to do good for the people, and if not last, when he's no longer a director, could be. So finally, I just want to conclude that this is the vision of, in a painting, Shang Shui painting, balance between the mountains and the sea, very famous in Chinese paintings, that you can have such kind of development, avatar style, and yet it is balanced, and this is the kind of thing that is just based on some idea from artists, and this is based on the philosophy. Can we also have Shang Shui cities, water, harmony, and so on? These are questions that we in Asia are trying to answer. There are no answers yet, but we have begun a discussion, a conversation. We hope to take this further in the Asian Parks Congress in 2021 in Sabah, where we will try to build on our philosophy to, in the face of contemporary challenges, to tackle climate change and so on. So thank you very much for your patience.